That's Stanley Turrentine. Okay, Stanley Turrentine on tenor sax with his own composition, Two Blue. It's from his 1973 album. That goes way back. Don't Mess with Mr. T. Bob James, also arranger on this number, on piano. Eric Gale on guitar, Ron Carter on bass, and Idris Muhammad on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And today we go back to developments with the Clinton Foundation, significant developments that you ought to know about, and we have been watching them. And so we should be talking about that today. The saga of the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation continues, and we are here to let you in on the latest developments. Several government officials from foreign governments, as a matter of fact, have indicated that they are pursuing investigations into the generous donations they have made over years to the foundation to fund many of its charitable programs around the world. And they want their money back and are taking legal action to get it. Their action could be a fatal blow to the foundation, but also personally to the Clintons. Documents and reports recently submitted to the IRS by the foundation after two extensions, most recently, still are not complete and again omit detailed accounting for all money received and how it was spent. We'll explain that. And although President-elect Donald Trump appears to have flip-flopped on his pre-election demand for a federal criminal investigation of the Clintons and their foundation, we've learned that one is ongoing anyway. And key players in the outgoing Obama administration are working feverishly to intercede in the Clintons' behalf before Trump takes office. Well, these and other issues will be our focus today. And I say our because Charles Ortel, the recognized expert on the Clinton Foundation and the person credited with exposing it as the, quote, largest unprosecuted charity fraud in history, unquote, is here with us. Thanks, Charles, for being with us today.
My great pleasure, Eutrice. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with what we said we were going to start about. That's what's going on with these foreign governments looking to get their money back. Could you talk about that?
Sure. So over the years, the Clinton Foundation has bragged repeatedly, and in theory, if everything had been done properly with some justification, about the great degree of support that this public charity has had from a raft of governments around the world. In the earlier years, from the foundation was started on October 23, 1997, through about 2008 or so, the Clinton Foundation refused to reveal just exactly which governments had been supporting it. But once Hillary was nominated by then-incoming President-elect Barack Obama to be Secretary of State, various negotiations took place, and it was decided that the Clinton Foundation would have to reveal information. And when they did, people were actually shocked to see just how many governments have been supporting it all along, big governments like Australia and Canada and Ireland and Norway, the Swedish Development Authority, and some many quasi-government entities had all been giving money. Now, when the Clinton Foundation made those 2008 disclosures, they took a victory lap, and Hillary in particular, for saying, you know, we're being more transparent than we have to be. When that was a bold-faced lie. Under New York law, the Clinton Foundation and any public charity operating and soliciting inside New York State is required on an annual basis starting in 2004 to provide incredibly detailed information, not only concerning the identities of each government donor, but concerning the branch within each government, the purpose of the grant, the amount of the grant. And this is something that, of course, the Clinton Foundation has yet to do. So we scroll forward to events of last year in 2015 when various people, including myself, were raising the issue of what exactly was going on at the Clinton Foundation. It seems more and more governments began to ask tougher and tougher questions. And I am told by a good source that the day after the election, on the 9th of 2016, a number of these people who had been silent rushed forward and said, hang on, you know, what is really going on here? And when you start pulling on the threads that I've been pulling on for these many months, when you do so as a government, which, of course, I'm not a government, but as a government that has control over the regulation of charities in countries where the Clinton Foundation has unwisely been operating, you can get answers quickly that has taken me very many months to push along here. So what I think we're seeing in the various announcements is that, particularly now that it becomes crystal clear that Hillary will not be president of the United States, this Jill Stein recount notwithstanding, these various governments are looking at this and they're first saying, now, we're going to cut off all future funding, but when you do that, you must ask yourself, well, why exactly and how much did I send to the Clinton Foundation and which piece of the Clinton Foundation, going how far back, and why is it reasonable for me to say, well, it's all right that I sent this to you and I haven't gotten the kind of accounting I require. Don't these foreign governments have an obligation to their own taxpayers? And I think they do. So what we're seeing out now, happening right now, prior to January 20th at noon 2017, when President Obama will be leaving office, I think we're seeing furious negotiations back and forth that are now going to only escalate as Team Clinton fights to get whatever cover they can get post Barack Obama's departure under a Trump administration to give them some protection, if they can get any, from the types of inquiries that likely will accelerate and accentuate at state level, at FBI and federal level, and around the world.
Well, let's take a look at some of the governments that have already rescinded or stopped making any further donations. Who would you count as the most significant members in that group?
Well, let's start with Australia. And there is a wonderful journalist out there, Michael Smith, who actually has had quite a career. He was a detective in the Australian, I'm not sure if it was the city police force or federal force. He was an executive in telecom. He drifted into a career in radio and as a journalist. He's been dogging this with me for well over a year, and using the contacts that he has down there in Australia, he has been relentlessly going after governments there to first expose the degree to which they've made contributions directly to the Clinton Foundation, and then to this web of Clinton Foundation affiliates. On Monday, another fantastic ally, you've had him on your show, Utrice, Richard Pollack of the Daily Caller, had a piece wherein he, through his investigating, I think working in part with Michael in Australia, believes that the government of Australia may have sent as much as $460 million U.S. dollars to the Clinton Foundation, to affiliates of the Clinton Foundation, and to affiliates of various former Australian government officials who are linked into the Clinton Foundation. So there you have a case in Australia where monies were sent over many years, going all the way back as early as 2006, in large quantity. Monies have been sent towards these Clinton Foundation, in quotes, initiatives, some fighting HIV/AIDS, others fighting, in quotes, climate change, when none of those entities were ever lawfully organized or operated from the inception of the HIV fighting thing in 2002, forward from the inception of the climate change in 2006 forward. So the Australian government is sending money who knows where exactly, to what bank accounts controlled by which affiliates of the Clinton Foundation, and there's never actually been a proper accounting for all that. And, you know, Australia is not a minor country, and not that any country is necessarily minor, but it has extensive interests all over the world, especially in Asia. And it thought, when you read through the various press releases issued by the government of Australia, it thought it was getting involved in projects in Papua New Guinea and Vietnam and China and in climate change globally and in forestry in various places. And, you know, what does it have to show for it? I think it has a lot of hot air.
Well, we also have countries like Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, the Netherlands. These countries are also looking to get their money back. So when it's all said and done, what kind of reserves does the Clinton Foundation have to give any of this money back at the moment?
Little to none. You see, I mean, the way this is in charities, you know, the problem the Clintons have here is that they organize these structures as public charities, being charities that solicit from the general public, in theory, to pursue only aims that have been approved in advance by our federal government and then by various states and foreign entities. When you operate in that guise, you don't have the same degree of flexibility that you might have as a corporation. In the for-profit world, corporations have wide latitude to basically do whatever they want to do, provided they comply with the law. Not so with charities. Charities have to pursue only specifically authorized purposes that are indeed charitable. That is to say, they must serve the public interest exclusively. It can't be a cover to make money or to extend your political influence. And so when you unwrap something like this, or as my children like to say, unpack, when you unpack the analysis here, if the government of Australia, let's say, gave money to the Clinton Foundation to provide HIV/AIDS medicines, specifically in remote portions of Papua New Guinea, and if the Clinton Foundation was not authorized to do that lawfully anywhere, let alone in Papua New Guinea, or to solicit money in Australia, then the Clinton Foundation, just for that piece of it, has exposure under Australian law for soliciting improperly, under, if there is law in Papua New Guinea, under Papua New Guinea law, certainly under U.S. law, and under state law. It's got just for that one set of issues. And, you know, Australia would have some leverage to try to get that money back from the Clinton Foundation. If there's nothing there, then the Australian government, if it chose to, could go against the trustees of the Clinton Foundation, who include some very wealthy people who do have money. And in addition, the way our laws are set up and the way certain other English-based, that is to say, the country of England-based legal systems, the way they work is that you have rights to go against significant donors to the Clinton Foundation on the grounds that you know, Australia would say, I wouldn't have put money in here if I hadn't seen that Bill Gates and Melinda Gates and the Rockefellers and Robert Wood Johnson and Fred Eichner and other well-known American wealthy long-standing foundations that have a reputation for being careful. If I hadn't seen them putting money in, I wouldn't have put money in. So the government of Australia could, in theory, and other governments around the world, could launch recovery lawsuits against these various players, many of whom would like to operate in Australia. So,
would some of those governments also be in good standing to sue the U.S. government, considering that this is the theory I'm going with, that the government of the United States failed to find that the Clinton Foundation was operating illegally and outside of the causes that it delineated when it applied to the IRS for tax-exempt status, and that the government of the United States in part shares some blame here because it failed to go after the Clinton Foundation to make sure that it was observing the law, charity law.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but I think the better path for a foreign government, rather than trying to go against the U.S. government, because you get into questions of sovereign immunity and stuff like that, would be to go against the trustees of the Clinton Foundation. There, you're on very strong ground. And indeed, our take the Bill Gates Foundation. They made an investment in, I think it's the Brazilian oil company, Petrobras. And they're suing, I believe that was a state-owned company, but they're suing, I think, the directors of Petrobras in a fraud case there. It's not uncommon for donors to go after charities or companies that are engaged in fraud, and you're where you have the greatest leverage as a government of Australia is going first against the trustees of the Clinton Foundation, and then second against the significant private foundation donors who did not do what they were supposed to do in terms of doing the kind of due diligence they should have done on the Clinton Foundation. I mean, these problems that I have found and others now see involving Clinton entities, they date to the very inception on October 23rd, 1997. I mean, that's a time when you go back into history. The Clintons were under siege for various reasons. And I would argue this foundation was born in fraud. It was nothing more than a platform to try to raise money to pay off the lawyers who were defending the Clintons for other matters. And it just got to be, it's been progressively an ever bigger and bigger and bigger fraud. You would have thought, at least I would have thought, and I did think when I got into this in the beginning, that people like Bill and Melinda Gates, who tightly control their own foundation, there are only three trustees of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Bill, Melinda, and Warren Buffett, each of whom is supposed to be pretty smart and certainly is very wealthy. So, you know, those people have given a lot of money over $100 million, maybe over $150 million to the Clinton Foundation from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And they've done it since 2002 or 2001. So, you know, why? And their pattern of support for this fraud has escalated over time. So if I were a government looking to get my money back from this Clinton Foundation entity, which likely will have little left by the time they get through with this mess, I would go after the trustees first. I would go after the significant donors second. And I would construct my argument along the lines of, you know, that a lot of people have failed in their fiduciary responsibility to protect people, to the general public, and I am harmed, and I demand my money back. And, you know, by placing a demand like that, the Australian government would have incredible, just to pick on them for a second, would have great leverage over anybody in the mix who intended to do business in Australia. And similarly, there's another government, the government of Norway, has given round numbers $100 million towards this packet of suspect charities. They could do the same thing. And there's an even bigger basket. There's $650 million or so U.S. dollars sent towards principally the HIV-AIDS fighting stuff by this entity in Switzerland that in turn is funded principally by the government of France. And the government of France has tremendous leverage here because most of these players have one connection one way or another to some part of territory directly controlled by the government of France, inside France, or influenced by the government of France around the world. And their legal system is very different than ours. You're guilty until proven innocent over there. So when the French government decides to make an issue of you, particularly inside France, you're in deep trouble.
The Clinton Foundation finally sent in or submitted its documents, which it's claiming to be a full report, and it's now within compliance after being extended twice a deadline by which to file. So you've had a chance to take a look. Have you seen that the foundation actually did provide all of the missing pieces and is now fully in compliance?
Absolutely not. I mean, I had reviewed the packet of materials, and it was absolutely, in my opinion, not in compliance at all. I mean, the Clinton Foundation, once again, got Price Waterhouse now for the third year to issue what is called an independent audit of its financial statements on false and materially misleading premises. I mean, the way an audit works is for a given year, this would be for 2015, it starts on December 31st, 2014, and it takes you through what happened during the 12 months of 2015. If the starting point is wrong, the ending point is wrong. The starting point for the year in 2014 is certainly wrong, because the starting point at 2013 is wrong, and 12 is wrong, and 11 is wrong, and 10 is wrong, and 2009 is wrong, and they failed to go back in to the very beginning, as they are required to do, to correct these previous errors. So all subsequent reports are wrong. And there are mathematical errors, there are factual errors, there are discrepancies that are not explained between amounts in the tax filings that are listed out as the major donors. Those do not agree with amounts in the major donors' tax filings concerning their payments to the Clinton Foundation. And all of this is stuff that the IRS could easily get for itself. I mean, I'm told by certain experts on how the IRS works that there was long ago an algorithm in place within the IRS that would match up disclosures on a given charity. And mind you, the Clinton Foundation has to send to the IRS the identities of all the donors. We don't get to see that from the public, but they have to disclose it to the IRS. And then the donors on their tax forms have to lay out the amounts and identities and addresses of the places they've sent money. So the IRS for many years has had an algorithm in place that would allow its agents to go in and quickly cross-check and discover the anomalies that I've had to discover just by understanding who the likely big donors are and checking the big donor disclosures versus the Clinton Foundation disclosures. But we're talking here, you know, many tens of millions of dollars, in some cases hundreds of millions of dollars of discrepancies. So these have never been reconciled and likely cannot be reconciled without confessing to fraud, which is why they're still wrong. A second piece here is that the Clinton Foundation cannot simply get away with just filing federal tax forms. It operates in all these states, so it has to file federal forms. It could be the fault of the New York State Charity Bureau, but as of yesterday, the New York State forms for 2015 were not yet online. And those still have not been corrected going back to 2004 to identify to the public, as is required, which governments, foreign and domestic, specifically have given what amounts to the Clinton Foundation in every year from 2004 forward. And the reason they haven't done that, my suspicion is because the second you start doing that, then all these alarm bells only escalate involving the governments.
Which means that the government will have to answer as to why it is over all these years, going back to the 1990s, the Clinton Foundation seemed to be exempt from oversight. And a reason has to be given, especially if the oversight, in looking at these oversights, one sees a pattern of, how could I say, bizarre accounting rules that are allowed to pass. And you see blatant examples of how the Clinton the Clinton Foundation was actually blatantly breaking charity law, because you would be able to see where the money's coming from, certainly, and they did not disclose certain things. And a lot of this would be apparent, and a lot of this would have triggered, if the IRS were doing its job, it would have triggered an investigation by now, not only on that level, but also probably triggering a criminal probe by now.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the question here for me, I mean, when I got onto this last February, March 2015, the issue to me wasn't, is there fraud? There's definitely fraud here. There's ongoing fraud, criminal and civil fraud. The issue for me is not, you know, that. The issue is, why has this fraud been allowed to go on for so long across in so many states, in so many foreign countries? You know, is this an example? I mean, there used to be a saying about lending that, you know, if you borrow $1 million from a bank and you get in trouble, you're in trouble. But if you borrow $1 billion from the bank, you own the bank. So you're not in trouble. I mean, is this a mess that is so big that it engulfs the political system? And because, you know, the skillful residents of the swamps, the various swamps, not just Washington, D.C., but all the state capitals and foreign capitals, they're able with this mess to look in and see, well, you know, there's the Bush family involved here, and so if you want to make an issue of this, you're going to have to implicate them. And that, you know, maybe that stops partisans, if there are partisans in the IRS and elsewhere, saying, well, we really can't blow this one up, because if we do, not only, of course, it implicates the Clintons and Democrats, but it also implicates Republicans. Let's just put this on the side. And the truth is that you know, I really do think the people across the political spectrum, when they give money to charity normally, they're doing it without regard to politics. They're not trying to help poor people because they're poor Democrats or poor Republicans. They're trying to help poor people or, you know, people who need support in one area or another. And that's the way most people in the vibrant and gigantic charity sector that is a special and wonderful feature of this country, that's the way they think in the main. So the people who operate this Clinton Foundation and their various initiatives and affiliates have, you know, as we've talked in the past, as they took advantage and are taking advantage of people in Haiti and elsewhere, once again here, they're taking advantage of the gullible. They're taking advantage of the regulators. They're taking advantage of, you know, the people in the various who operate the levers of power, thinking that, you know, yeah, it's a mess, but if you now expose it, you're going to have to explain to the public why you didn't catch it October 23, 1997. And that's going to make you look stupid. And this is a technique that I think adept fraudsters use. They get you involved. Take Madoff. You know, Madoff is a classic and similar case. You know, here you have, in Madoff, you have thousands of very smart people who had accumulated large amounts of money and, you know, who knew better than to give all of their money to an operator whose returns looked great on paper but couldn't be verified. Yet thousands of people did that. Thousands of people until, you know, the wheels of justice turned, thousands of people for a number of months and years thought they'd lost everything. And, you know, that fraud was a fraction. I think, that, you know, depending on how you count it, it was $60 billion, but then there were recoveries, so maybe it's only $20 billion in that range, $20, $30, $60 billion. This thing, when you count not simply the charities, but also the private gains and the deals and everything else, the enormous that has been created through this thing, this could well be in the hundreds of billions, trillions of dollars. And, you know, the fraudsters are counting, I think, on you know, the status quo pre-Trump of the establishment and both parties saying, you know, we really don't want to rock the boat here because we need to protect this crooked system. And I think, you know, what could well happen here, assuming things proceed the way that I believe they might, is that this case can be used effectively by those who would like to move the regulatory apparatus concerning charities into the 21st century, into 2016, to empower regulators to, you know, with the tools that are required to discipline this type of a charity that, on the face of it, you know, a charity operated by a former president is likely to have people around it who care about politics and political advantage for the party of the former president. So that right there should put regulators on notice, because charities are not supposed to be involved in political activities and partisan political activities. So one warning flag right there. The next warning flag would be that, you know, this charity drifted into international activities, into raising money internationally. And foreign parties are not supposed to get involved in U.S. domestic politics. So there's your second red flag. So you look at this, we find out what really happened. There must be examples of other charities involving Republicans and neutral people, progressive people, whatever. This, I think, is a big enough case, and it's a good an opportune time to have people, perhaps, you know, towards the second half of next year, have some congressional oversight, some real hearings of how the charity laws should best be reformed to protect donors, to protect the public, to protect the reputation of the charity world as what it used to be, the platinum standard for how charities operate globally. I think it's time for congressional hearings, probably House and Senate hearings on this matter. And all the while, I think we need to let this investigation go. The public needs to understand what really happened at this public charity. You know, who was in charge of it? Why did they allow these controls? Why did they game the controls so that they didn't function? Why did the accounting firms not do their job? Why did this go on, you know, for so many months and years? And why were the regulators inside and outside the U.S. asleep at the switch for so long?
Well, I'm tending to believe that it is also bigger than that. This is a whole new kind, at least to my thinking, of organized crime. This isn't just a matter of making a lot of money, but I'm thinking of the products, if you will, up for sale, being offered for sale. They also involve confidential information. They involve what one would consider to be government privileged information. They involved access. They involved, in fact, dealing with people who were known criminals wherever they operated from. I mean, how does Hillary Clinton get away with entering into an arrangement to allow 20% of U.S. uranium to be sold to a foreign entity on the so-called black market, if you will, through her own initiative privately? How do you classify this kind of crime? This isn't just about, you know, using the philanthropic front or using charity, the architecture of charity to make money. This is about people making money with some really very sensitive products and services that they don't own, but that they can facilitate the sale of. So to my mind, this takes this thing off the charts. It goes way off the charts as ordinary crime. This is not just a Bernie Madoff transaction where the whole point is just make a whole ton of money with other people's money. This is involving state secrets, state information, privileged information, insider information. This is the kind of complexity that enters the picture, don't you think?
I do. So what's happened, I think, is in the modern world for the moment, you know, where if you have a good idea and perseverance and you get lucky, you can come up with a product or service that you can sell rapidly to the global market. And you can make, as Mark Zuckerberg has made, without really selling a product, just selling advertising, you know, you could become worth in the tens of billions of dollars. So then you turn your attention to the various governments around the world, and there are common threads to this mess that I see. One is that in two spheres in particular, in natural resources and in telecommunications, the leaders of governments around the world have in their hand the ability to make tons of money for their political friends, and if they're really crooked, for themselves. I mean, if you are sitting in Haiti, as Hillary Clinton's brother found, and you know you have ties to that government, you can get an off-market concession to exploit the gold resources of the country, or the timber resources, or the oil, or gas, or coal resources. So that's an area that strikes me deserves special scrutiny. And then also in the area of telecommunications, you know, one of the richest trustees of the Clinton Foundation, his name is Mohammed Ibrahim, is one of the richest, if not the richest man in Africa, for having figured out that early on that cell mobile was the way to go and for getting these franchises. Dennis O'Brien's another guy from Ireland who's made a lot of money off this. So the decision by a government to award a cell phone franchise is something that is, or other types of spectrum, is enormously valuable. And this is an area where, you know, there ought to be great scrutiny over, you know, how are these gigantic contracts and licenses awarded? And there aren't, because, you know, it just goes over the heads of most of the journalists, and sometimes it's complicated stuff. But, you know, the fraudsters and the inside players understand that for a relatively paltry amount of money, you can go from having no chance of getting to an oil contract to getting the oil contract or the cell phone license or whatever else. And so I think there should be some rigorous analysis of what happened. You know, going over perhaps all the way back to, you know, 1999, maybe before that. You know, what happened with these various contracts and license awards around the world? You know, who got them and on what basis involving Americans and charities run by Americans? And then you get into the question, another thing we haven't really talked about much is that the United States is so influential for the moment in many, many multilateral organizations like the World Bank, the International Finance Corporation, and others. And government officials and those connected to federal government officials can make it possible to steer valuable subsidies, valuable loans, valuable investments to political friends. And that's a whole area that needs, again, to be looked at. You know, why is it that Digicel, this Irish company, and was originally in Ireland, run by an Irish fellow, Dennis O'Brien, and his team, a private company, why has that company been able to tap so effectively into the International Finance Corporation for many hundreds of millions of dollars of loans and equity and other investments? And that's just one of his companies. You know, how do these loan commitments get parceled out? That's big money. So you give a politician $1 million and you get back a loan for $500 million that's off market. You know, if you're crooked, you'll do that. And I'm not saying Dennis O'Brien specifically did that technique, but I am saying that, you know, this is an area that really needs to be studied carefully by people who understand finance, who can see the cross connections around the world, and who have the authority to really dig in here.
In the meantime, we have an issue of flip-flopping. Donald Trump, at the crescendo of the election, was talking about prosecuting Hillary Clinton. Then recently he's been saying, well, you know, we just need to move on. And recently he gave her even another get-out-of-jail card, indicating that he's interested in moving beyond it. What do you think accounts for this flip-flop? And do you think it would basically affect the future or the possibility of prosecuting this case?
Well, I certainly would like to think that the way the wheels of justice work in our country is that the President of the United States and indeed any senior official, vice president, cabinet official, other than the attorney general, has little to do with how, you know, the prosecuting attorneys actually, prosecuting federal attorneys actually move forward deciding what cases ought to be taken to court and how those cases ought to move along. Because the last thing I would like to see in this country is, you know, whether it's Barack Obama or Donald Trump, getting mired in that type of minutia. Now, what I think Trump was saying back then, and that was, what, last week or several weeks ago, I think what he was saying is that that he personally was not going to order an investigation of Hillary Clinton. Well, of course, he does. That's not the way things work. I don't think the President of the United States wakes up in the morning and says, well, you know, I don't like this guy Ortel. He's, you know, I'm going to go after him. Please, you know, go after him. I don't think you can do that. So he was, I think, trying to calm the waters. And what he didn't say and what others have clarified for him is that there's a lot of confusion about what sort of investigations may be brewing here. There is, we're told, an IRS review. And I understand an IRS review is the first step that then can escalate up into a full-scale audit. It has been in process from the Dallas office of the IRS for many months. There are supposedly also FBI field office investigations looking at various issues, but I believe a rather robust investigation potentially looking into all aspects of the Clinton Foundation. And Donald Trump was absolutely silent on that. The president also doesn't really have the ability to stop the FBI or the Department of Justice from proceeding with an investigation. I mean, that's not something you're supposed to do. You're either supposed to spur one or stop it. You know, the wheels of justice are supposed to be blind. So I think what Donald Trump was doing in those statements was he was trying to be conciliatory generally. And I think he's learning that the media are never going to be happy with him. It's going to take he will have to. I mean, I think he made the comment that during the course of the campaign, one of the many ill-advised comments that he made, I think he said that he could walk down the street on Fifth Avenue and murder somebody, and he'd still become president of the United States. I mean, he was overstating his popularity, I think, just a little bit. But equally, the flip side of the coin here is that you know, CNN is never going to be happy with Donald Trump. You know, if the economy started growing at 8% a year, the Dow Jones Industrial Average went to 100,000 from 19,000, and, you know, there were no – we cut the work week 3 days a week, and everybody was making $1 million a year, CNN would still say that Donald Trump was a disaster. And I think he's learning that. And the same may be true of the New York Times. So he was trying to be, you know, I think, extend an olive branch. He sees what happens now, and he's proceeding full speed ahead.
But, you know, we already have indications that the presidency is not immune to, you know, under-the-table dealings either. You have Barack Obama, who I am positive, that there is no rational explanation for why this particular foundation escaped scrutiny for this long. It's because somebody made it known that this is what the president wants. And basically, Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton and the Clinton Foundation, all of them were allowed to slide. Similarly, I think it is the case with Donald Trump that he does not want, having gotten some kind of idea of how Washington works, that he does not want to be responsible for prosecuting Hillary Clinton. We see that the FBI backed off. We see that the Justice Department under Obama backed off. We see that the IRS under Obama backed off. And we see that Obama himself backed off. So it must be a carryover effect where we see that Donald Trump does not want to take on the burden of being the guy who puts Hillary Clinton in jail. You're right. The president shouldn't be the one making a call as to who gets prosecuted, who does not get prosecuted. But we saw it happen time and again under Obama. The Obama administration was very selective and in some cases overreaching in determining who gets prosecuted and who does not get prosecuted, who gets let off and who does not get let off. And now I think with this recount that Hillary Clinton sees the door open for her to step in under the recount requested by the Green Party and Jill Stein, it's very interesting to note her language. This is Hillary's language when she says that we will kind of go in under taking their lead. We will be part of that recount too, which says to Trump, if he were inclined to give her a break, this is another slap in his face to say, hey, I can do whatever I want to do, and I know you can't do me anything. You can't touch me. It's a stupid move on her part, but, you know, it's politics.
Yeah, I mean, I think if we separate the two main strands of the investigations, of course, we don't really know what they are, which is the proper way to do these. I mean, I don't think the general public should be told exactly how an investigation might be moving until you get to the indictment stage, because, you know, if a decision is made not to proceed, well, all right, it didn't meet the requisite standards. And, you know, maybe you go down an alley, you think somebody deserves prosecution, and it turns out that they really didn't. So we don't really know, but there are these two main strands. One is the email scandal, and that, uh-huh. in my mind, likely involves the questions of whether highly sensitive, classified, super secret information was negligently handled or may have fallen into the hands of our enemies. Now, that is, you can imagine, especially given the way they decided to do this, you know, operating a secret private server in various residences, not just in Washington, D.C., but also, it seems, in Chappaqua, and not just while she was Secretary of State, but before and after and during. The decision to operate, you know, a secret set of servers, also while having a secret office at the Clinton Foundation down at 77 Water Street that isn't disclosed in the Clinton Foundation filings properly, you could imagine that, you know, one of the things our government might be concerned about pursuing that type of investigation is that if you get into an open courtroom, you know, if you're trying to press your case against the Clintons, what secrets end up getting revealed to the world at large about how we run the nation's super secret business. So you can, I could see why, for a raft of reasons, the federal officials and indeed the national security apparatus of this country would be very concerned about, you know, exactly how you might navigate those set of issues. Now, that said, you know, when you have a Jonathan Pollard, you know, who was giving away secrets, I think, to the Israelis, and when you have others giving away secrets to the Chinese and other countries, and decisions are made to land on people for, you know, one or two or three or a limited number of incidences, they get normally treated pretty harshly. So by treating the Clintons on national security issues the way we've been treating them, I would argue we've been giving them far greater deference than they deserve for that strand of it. Then on the other strand, the Clinton Foundation one, that's one where I, you know, not just because I've invested so much time and we've invested, you and I treat so much time talking about this, that's an area where I think no leniency is owed, particularly given the example of Corinne Brown. I don't know yet what's happened to her. I don't know if you've heard, Yatrice, but...
No, I checked. I don't see what movement there was. She was supposed to be changing lawyers, I believe.
So, I mean, therefore, an $800,000 alleged slush fund, you know, she faces many years, hundreds of years in prison, and here for multiple, you know, declared billions and, you know, undeclared who knows how much money, for some reason, there's no action against the Clintons. And I don't think we want a standard in this country that, you know, once you get elected president, that's a get-out-of-jail-free card for life. I mean, that certainly would send the wrong message, I think, to people. And same token if you're a congressperson or senator or secretary of state. I mean, and the further consideration in this case would be, you know, if you were Harry Truman, who I understand, you know, once he finished his presidency, the history books suggest that he didn't really have much money. And, you know, he got in a car and, you know, drove out to, I guess, Kansas, I think it was. And I think he drove himself and went looking for work. I mean, it's not like the Clintons are Harry Truman. I mean, they're not sitting there on the sidewalk, you know, on a cardboard box in a tin can asking for money. And they've done very well, thank you very much, for all their years in, quote, public service. So,
but
you know. But this
issue of the servers, again, this is why I'm saying this is a very different kind of crime, because the servers also were offline and hidden all over the place and in people's basements and whatnot, because they were central to the sales of the products that Hillary was selling, which is, tell me what you want, I'll tell you how much it would cost, and nobody would know, because this information is within a network that the Clintons created that operated under the veneer of a philanthropy, this foundation, but the foundation was secreted in these offices. Some of them, they got free office space, and they were operating these computers basically as their own shadow sales force. And they were selling government knowledge, government material to the highest bidders. This is why it's such a strange kind of crime. But we'll see how they deal with it.
Yes,
what do you expect? What do you expect in the coming weeks would be happening? We talked about the fact that these governments are looking for money back. The legal effort, of course, will back that up. But do you expect more and more governments to sign on to this idea of demanding their money back? Do you expect that the Clintons somehow will react by, I don't know, even considering could they consider bankruptcy?
Bankruptcy wouldn't really help them very much. You see,
the foundation going bankrupt, in other words.
That won't really help them, because you know, the claims would be against the trustees and against the Clintons or trustees. And so there's going to be, everybody around this can't go bankrupt. And Bill Gates, I don't think, is going to go bankrupt. You know, the trustees of the Rockefeller Foundation won't go bankrupt. Michael Bloomberg won't go bankrupt. There's going to be, Haim Saban and Mo Ibrahim and others, multi-billionaires associated with this won't go bankrupt. So there's a way, I believe, to get money back here. And what is going to happen, you know, I think let's turn our attention, for example, to the biggest single donor to the Clinton Foundation, and that would be the government of France, on behalf of travelers who traveled through France, sent a bunch of money into this Unitaid thing in Switzerland, and never checked to see what happened with that money. And that money then went to this HIV/AIDS thing, starting in the case of Unitaid, starting in November, December 2006 forward. Now, there's a little thing going on in France that's going to be even more acrimonious than our election, and that involves this Marine Le Pen, who's, let's say, pretty far to the right, and then the other fellow was a conservative, I forget his exact name, who just won the runoff for the equivalent of a primary.
Fallon.
Okay. So each of those people has every right inside France to ask the question, you know, why did the previous governments of France allow so much money to be taken, to really be stolen and diverted to the Clinton family, this Clinton Foundation HIV/AIDS thing? Why did they let that happen for so many years? And why did Unitaid and the French government exercised such poor control over, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, not ensuring that this money actually avoided being used to buy potentially adulterated, harmful HIV/AIDS medicine? And why did this happen? Who's responsible for this? I mean, here you have two candidates in France who would be natural people to compete to rev the pressure up. And the French government, I'm told, is already studying this. So, you know, you're gonna have different points of view. As it's one of the great things about life. You know, people have different points of view, and sometimes your national spirits are slightly different. There'll be a French perspective and a Swedish perspective and a Norwegian perspective and an English perspective. I mean, there's a large sum of money has come out of England to this fraud. Why don't they get the money back?
Well, we'll have to leave it there for today. We're out of time, but this has been one heck of an update on the Clinton Foundation, and expect more to come because it's being, I don't know, it's left alone to be quiet. So in the event that something major happens, we probably wouldn't know, but we're keeping an eye on it. Thank you, Charles, for being with us today and for coursing us through these developments so far.
Thank you, Yatrice.
Thanks. Stay tuned. Coming up next, The Infectious Myth with David Crow. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. As always, a pleasure and a great, great privilege to be in your company. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye.